Good morning, Mr. Cavalpaul. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I've taken some heat from some of my friends and more liberal listeners because I have some qualms about the term white privilege, but I want you to define it for us, and we'll get through what we need to do. What are the specific problems with that result from white privilege? Let's start with your definition of the term.
I think that we're really talking about racism, and some people use the phrase white supremacy, the fact that, you know, systematically in our society, people of color experience a lot more exploitation, discrimination, and marginalization based upon what are perceived to be racial differences but really aren't. And one result of that is that in all spheres of our social and economic life, white people get benefits that people of color in general don't. They're treated differentially. And we can see that in terms of the disproportional outcomes in health care and housing and schools and things like that. So white privilege is a subset, is one of the results of racial injustice. Given that as kind of a framework, I don't actually use the word privilege so much. I talk about benefits. What are benefits that white people accrue from being white in a racially unequal society? Because privilege is a hard term to relate to if you're white and you don't have much economic advantage. And it can feel like, well, this isn't a conversation that I'm a part of. And it's true that poor and working class white people don't really have privileges, but they do have some benefits. They do get some better treatment, better options than similarly situated people of color, particularly Black and Latinos and Native Americans.
Can you give us some examples of that? By the way, Paul Cavell with us, the website, Paul Cavell, KIVEL.com. And he is an educator, activist, and writer, also conducts workshops, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I appreciate that you made that distinction, Paul, because it's one I've made many times. I don't think it's I don't think it's honest, honestly. I don't think it's a correct use of the word privilege to describe somebody who's homeless, who sleeps under bridges, or who just had his job offshored to Asia as privilege. But you say that, nevertheless, compared to similarly situated African Americans, Latinos, a white person may be slightly better off, may have some advantages. Could you share those with us, please?
Well, one clear one is often better treatment by the police. In general, people of color, and African Americans in particular, are racially profiled a lot and surveilled a lot more and stopped for a lot more and arrested a lot more and charged for higher terms for the same crimes than similarly situated white people. So just the treatment on the street but it goes much further than that, because all of our institutions in terms of the social welfare system, the foster care system, the health care system, when you walk in the door as a white person, there's some assumptions made that you're not in general dangerous, that you're not in general trying to rip off the system. And these are assumptions that people of color meet every day in their interactions in mainstream society. So it's true if you walk into a store. It's true if you go into a hospital or an emergency room. It's true if you apply for benefits, that systematically people and our institutions have racial prejudices, prejudgments, stereotypes, negative images, which lead to differential treatment.
Do you think that, I'm not going to dispute that. I think that's almost certainly true. But do you think it goes the other way as well? For example, do people assume that white folks are clueless, that they're oblivious to the challenges that people of color face, when maybe many whites are not, such as yourself, incapable of empathizing?
I mean, any generalization is, you know, limited in its usefulness. But, you know, I mean, overall, the polls continually show that white people think that racism is not a problem. It's like 25% of the white population thinks it's a problem, and most of those think it's just it's an occasional problem, or it's about extremist groups, or it's not, you know, it's not a serious problem. So, you know, you can make a generalization that white people are clueless and it won't cover all white people, but there's, you know, it's not inaccurate in that it captures a general, you know, information that most white people don't treat racism seriously, even when there is visible evidence all of the time. And we've seen this with all of the murder of young black men and young black women by the police, that it there's always ways that as white people we try to excuse that or explain that or talk about it as exceptional. Whereas, you know, if you're black or Latino or Native American, you face this all of the time, and you know that it's systematic, it's pervasive, it's not just an occasional aberration.
All right, Paul Cavell with us. What should we do? What should we do about the disparate experiences, the significantly less pleasant experiences that so many Americans of color face versus their white counterparts?
I think there's several things we can do. One is we need to start by acknowledging some of the benefits that we do have. We can't be in denial that this is a system that operates to give us some limited sense of benefits. Now, of course, the majority of the benefits accrue to the 1%, the ruling class in our country. So it's not like, you know, most white people are rolling in affluence or wealth or privilege, but we have to acknowledge that we live on Native American land, for instance, stolen land.
Well, why can't we say, look, we have people in this country who are really, really poor. That's a problem. We've got to address that right now. We've got to guarantee what I believe, by the way, we've got to guarantee every single American safe, warm place to sleep every single night, period. We need to guarantee every single American good education that's either free or affordable. We've got to guarantee every single American health care. Why can't we do that without going through this exercise of acknowledging that at every income level, for example, it's worse to be of color? I mean, I'm not saying that that's not true. I'm asking you why we need to acknowledge that to address the specific pathologies in American society that disproportionately affect people of color.
I think the main reason we need to do that is because racism is so deeply embedded in our society that whenever we set up systems, whether it's Social Security or public education, that unless we deal with the deep legacy of racism and the current reality of it, that we end up reproducing racial disparities. And so, you know, we claim to have universal kinds of systems, but inevitably they marginalize or discriminate against people of color. So we could aspire for all those. Those are great things to aspire to, but we can't actually achieve them without acknowledging and dealing with both the legacy and the current reality of racial injustice in our society.
Well, give us an example of that. Paul Cavell with us, paulcavell.com. I think this is a fascinating conversation. We're coming at problems in America a little bit different, in a slightly different way, but I think we both want to get to the same place. How is, for example, the Social Security system rigged against people of color?
Well, let's start historically. When Social Security was set up in the 1930s, there were two groups that were excluded from it because in order to get it passed, Roosevelt needed the support of white Southern representatives and senators. So the two groups that were excluded were farm workers and domestic workers because they were primarily African American. And so it was a trade-off. So we set up the system of Social Security that covered everybody except the two largest groups of working African Americans. And that is still true today. Domestic workers are still not covered, and farm workers are often not covered as well. And there's currently, you know, domestic workers are fighting for inclusion in exactly that system. Now, this is 75 years after this universal system was set up.
I'll tell you what, let me just hold that thought because we've got a break. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Paul Cavell. All right, back on the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, talking to Paul Kivel, and I pronounced your name incorrectly. I appreciate the correction. I apologize for that. Paul Kivel, Paul, K-I-V-E-L, paulkivel.com. And you just wanted to kind of finish what you were saying, Paul, about the differentiation between workers when it comes to Social Security and other programs and how such differentiation negatively impacts on African Americans especially.
Right. Just a couple of other things. Because of tremendous wage discrimination that people of color often make much less wages than white people for doing comparable work, then they earn a lot less in the Social Security system. And because people of color, particularly African Americans, have much shorter lifespans, they reap a lot fewer benefits. And, of course, the government has been pushing the age limit on when you can take those benefits higher and higher, which means that each time that's done, that's another blow to African Americans who, because of health care disparities based on race, often, that they actually reap fewer benefits from the Social Security system. So you can see the complicated way that these disadvantages are layered in our society and are cumulative.
But to be fair, those disadvantages to a large extent are as much class or income-based or wealth-based as they are race-based. And certainly I'm not disputing what you're saying about the origins of Social Security, but again, it seems to me if we address poverty, if we say we're going to address poverty, period, that would address many of the exact concerns that you are raising.
It would address some of them, and we always have to be talking about race and class together, because they're very intertwined. But it won't eliminate the deeply racialized outcomes that our institutions perpetuate over and over again. So we do need to focus on the economics, but it's historically over and over again we found that if we only focus on the economics, then we continue to perpetuate the racial disparities.
All right, Paul Kivel with us on The Morning Show. Go ahead. I cut you off. What was your next comment?
Well, I think that once we recognize that there are benefits to being white and that those benefits are unfair and they're tremendously destructive to people of color, leading to shorter lifespans and higher levels of violence and discrimination and marginalization, people, we need to say,
well, should we take them away? See, this is where you're getting towards the privilege. You're saying that there are benefits that whites are getting that are hurting blacks. I didn't really hear a lot of benefits that strike me as hurting blacks. What I heard are basically a litany of rights that may be not being afforded, what should be considered rights. For example, a comfortable retirement, getting a fair return after a lifelong life of hard work, getting a comfortable return. It seems to me those are what we should afford all of us, not what we should say are unfairly given white people and therefore should be removed from them.
Right. In that sense, that's true for some of those things. Other things are benefits that we enjoy lower costs for food because farm workers are paid so little. We enjoy a lower cost for clothes because people of color
we pretty much pay the same prices for food. Anyone who goes into any store will pay the same price. You can't price discriminate. And the terrible let's say first world privileges that we do enjoy as consumers, because products are made in Haiti for, you know, by people who get paid 35 cents to make a T-shirt, or in China for a dollar an hour. Those are also hurt us as a nation. They hurt all of us as a nation as they erode our manufacturing base.
Well, of course, there are repercussions that are complex, but it is true that a lot of the benefits as consumers we have in terms of our cell phones, our computers, our clothes, our food, is directly at the expense of people of color in this country and other countries who are working for low wages and often dangerous situations with little recognition. And we don't even pay attention to that. We just assume that we have entitlement to these kinds of benefits. So anyway, I think that we have to recognize that we do live in a country that where people are treated differently based on race, and it's well documented in all of our institutions, and it's playing out now in the heightened awareness of the way the police system, the criminal legal system, the prison industrial complex all play out to amplify racial disparities. And we have to take responsibility for stepping up and supporting the struggles that will change that will produce economic prosperity for everybody and decent and healthy lives for everybody. But that means also addressing the racialized system that continues to perpetrate disproportionate outcomes.
All right, how do we do that?
I think that there's a lot of people in our communities around the country who are organizing right now in terms of Black Lives Matter, specifically around disparities in the policing and police brutality, racial profiling, incarceration. And we can join those struggles, support those struggles. There's a lot of people organizing around our educational system and the disproportionate outcomes and discrimination in that system, and also in the healthcare system, and so it's about looking around in our neighborhoods and in our communities and finding out what people are actually doing to respond and getting involved with something. And many of our neighborhoods are being gentrified, and one of the impacts of that is that people of color and low-income people in general are getting pushed out of our communities and out of our cities and even out of our suburbs. So we need to get together with other people and talk about that. And what impact is that having on our schools, on the housing prices, on all kinds of things? And say to ourselves, I do benefit from the system. I'm upset about the injustice of it. It has costs for me because all of these systems perpetrate the overall economic inequality and move money up the pyramid to the ruling class. And so unless we're able to work together across racial lines, we're not actually going to be able to build healthy, sustainable communities.
I agree with that. I think that's exactly correct. I do not have any disagreement. I guess my concern is that sometimes the focus, I think, from some in this movement tends to pit people against each other based on race rather than based on class. And if you focus on the so-called privileges or unjust benefits that some white people get, it seems to me that you're making it harder to get them to rally behind the cause, because they will say to themselves, my life ain't very good. Most people don't say, I'm so lucky, everything's great. They may say to themselves, things aren't that good for me. I don't have a lot of retirement money. And you know what? The land-grant college system makes it just affordable for my kids to go to college, or the Social Security system as it's currently laid out now. Maybe it's not fair to people of color, or it gives unfair benefits to me, but it makes it just possible for me to live an okay life. And now I'm being told I'm supposed to give these up, and so I'm not going to do it. So to me, the language, the rhetoric, can make it tougher for people who have similar economic issues to join forces. Is that a fair concern for me to have?
Well, I think it's broadly, it's a fair concern. But if we're at the same time, if we're silent around race, if we don't actually acknowledge and address racial inequalities, we can't build the kind of broad-based, multiracial, multi-class movements that are really needed to shift our country. And so we have to be talking about both. And it's not a distraction for people to bring up race. It adds to our effectiveness, our strategic effectiveness, to be able to include race and gender and lots of other issues into building a movement that really represents all of us.
All right, before I let you go,
the only way
before I let
that
you,
we're going to seriously change
we
things.
We got one more minute left, real quick. How does the success of Asians fit into the theory of a society that focuses on benefiting white people?
Well, I think that the Asians communities are very complex. There's folks who are very poor and are treated similarly to how Black and Latinos are treated, and there's some who are very wealthy or well off or doing well. We need to include Asians in all communities in our collective struggles for liberation and a healthy and sustainable society. And so we have to keep coming back to the complexity of it and not trying to simplify it by saying, well, it's only class, really. Race doesn't have anything to do with it. We have to be talking about all of it together so that we can include everybody and build the collective power that leads to real change.
All right, Paul, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning on The Morning Show. I'll be right back. It's Paul Kivel, PaulKivel.com. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong.